Hello and welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Alvaro Hodge and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined by my friends
Giselle Donnelly. I also work at AEI and
Yulia Zsozsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown and George Washington Universities.
On our podcast, we talk about the challenges to European peace and security that have erupted along a line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Today it's just the three of us. We wanted to pause and reflect on the passage in the House and then in the Senate of the Ukraine supplemental bill alongside other pieces of legislation that have complemented it. We wanted to reflect both on the politics of this moment, on the significance of this legislation for Ukraine's prospects in this war. We also wanted to sort of think about the possible ramifications in Europe and in the defense industry on both sides of the Atlantic. Yulia is the one who has actually read the bill, and so she'll be able to provide details, including specific references to pages and lines of the text. So rely on her expertise, and Giselle and I will, you know, offer free-flowing commentary on various aspects of the bills. So, Yulia, why don't you get us started by sharing your impressions of, you know, how the bill is written, how much of a game changer it is in your opinion, and we'll then sort of assess different aspects of this in greater detail going forward.
Happy to do that. But before that, I want to highlight to our audience that Dalibor is selling Giselle and Dalibor shorts. And it's not just free-flowing commentary, but we will also sneak peek talk a little bit about, thanks to Dalibor's expertise, to talk about the financial implications in the long term, including the possibility of seizing the assets and what that can mean for Ukraine in the long term. And I know Giselle is going to contradict me here, and I'm looking forward to it, but I'll just throw out there a few things in terms of how I've read the bill, and then we can comment on it politically. First of all, we have the responsibility to manage expectations, and with the risk of pointing out the obvious, this is not going to radically shift the balance in my understanding, because we're dealing with a sum that is similar to what we've had in the last year. And we're dealing with a Russia that is deeply entrenched in some parts of the front line with 7 or 8 lines of defense. And so I think it's important to manage expectations there. To me, when we're looking at the financial part of it, it's interesting that for the first time, we have a granularity that maybe holds the administration responsible. Maybe that's a theme, holding the administration responsible, because we have a part of the funds that are allocated to replenishing old stocks on the U.S. side. And we had news about that already in March, that the U.S. stocks have been emptied worth more than $10 billion. I think the sum that is allocated for replenishing stocks on the U.S. side is $13 billion. So it kind of provides for that. And it's a lot. It's a significant part of the bill. Then we have, I think for the first time, an allocation of funds in a smaller sum, but nevertheless for new weapons for Ukraine. Hallelujah. That would be the first time that we're not giving them old stuff, partially almost unfunctioning stuff. And I wonder, maybe Giselle can talk a little bit about how that can make an impact depending on what can be bought and what the administration also is willing to buy for Ukraine, and also what we're able to produce, as Dalibor mentioned a bit earlier. And then the last short part here, a bit interesting. We've had a lot of discussions in the media around the time of the bill of loans, and loans are part of that. When it comes to economic assistance for the first time, it's important to know here that on the European side, it's been most loans, not grants. On the US side, it's been grants. So we have elements there, and we have part of the bill that specifies that out of the economic aid for Ukraine, there should be no pensions paid. And that speaks to corruption in the region, and I find it kind of understandable. A lot of money goes into pensions, not just Ukraine, but across the eastern flank / eastern front. So that's understandable. The other element that I'll throw out there, and then I'll shut up for a while, is the strategic part that I alluded to when I said that this bill is trying to hold the administration accountable, because it forces the administration to provide not just reports, but a strategy a strategy with, quote, achievable goals and objectives that has to be renewed or adjusted quarter by quarter. There's a time limit for the strategy. It's specifically for Ukraine, but it basically says the administration has been a bit free riding when it comes to the aims, the old discussion about Ukraine should not be losing as opposed to Ukraine should be winning. And so that to me is the most interesting part. And it specifies, I think it's section 504, but that's the most interesting part to me. It's a long paragraph about how the strategy should be drafted when it's due, and that it should include, again, for the first time, clear elements of connection between Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. And that, to me, is very much linked to Mike Johnson when he announced the bill going through, saying, talking for the first time of, I have seen intelligence, this is the axis of evil, he called it, and the connections between Russia, China, and Iran, particularly North Korea secondarily, are obvious. And I've seen that language replicated in the administration too, because Antony Blinken last year was saying about China, oh, it's marginal, and the Europeans were sort of playing it down and hoping that China can still play a mediating role or cannot do that much damage. And I think it was last week when Antony Blinken came out and said China is the main supporter of the reconstruction of Russia's defense industrial capacity. So I'm basically seeing through this bill holding the administration accountable, but also the administration taking these steps to fit with the requirements of the bill on the strategy. And precursor here on ATACMS, because I know Giselle wants to talk about ATACMS, but I'll leave it at that.
Boy, that was quite a tour de force, Julia. I'm very impressed. All I can do is maybe paint the lily a little bit to start with. And rather than talk about ATACMS, although the New York Times does report today that the Biden administration had already sent a handful of missiles to Ukraine, which were used in an apparently very effective strike behind Russian lines, particularly on an airfield in Crimea. So let's talk about the importance of Ukraine being able to strike at greater ranges, both for the near term and for longer term, larger scale successes. Neither side in this war has been able to mount anything remotely like an armored breakthrough that blasts a hole in the enemy's front lines or the opponent's front lines and then exploits it to achieve anything really decisive. What has changed the game, and what, you know, particularly as the narrative of Russian inevitable victory has kind of gained steam over as the Congress has twiddled its thumbs over the last 6 months, what's been missed is that the Ukrainians have, even prior to the delivery of much in the way of Western or American deep strike weapons, been able to cobble together through their own ingenuity the ability to hold targets in Russia, and importantly, not just the military technical thing, but by doing so, they've kind of breached a red line. The Biden administration visibly unhappy, even though it was just slightly over the border. And the Ukrainians have had great success in banishing the Russian surface navy from the western part of the Black Sea. So I think looking forward, it's become obvious to all, even lukewarm supporters like of Ukraine, that this is, you know, the sort of key to unfreezing the battlefield. You know, forward deployed troops who cannot be supplied are not all that effective. So if this aid package reflects not only the need to resupply Ukraine with shorter range cannon artillery shells, but longer range systems. It seems to me two things are quite possible. First of all, that the Russian offensive that everybody's been writing about, fretting over for the last couple of months, now is likely to face a much tougher task than it would otherwise. That may not bother Vladimir Putin, but, you know, the cost in blood of any attack is likely to go up a lot. It might even make the Russians think twice about going for broke in a way that would cast a pall over the upcoming NATO summit, et cetera, et cetera. So the sort of window of opportunity for the Russians is about to narrow quite substantially, and I hope quite quickly. I'm going to stop there, but I think it's worth exploring through how the dynamic might change. The geopolitical dynamic could easily shift again in favor of a narrative centered on Ukrainian success rather than Ukrainian defeat. And I think that's got to be a precursor to any larger, longer-term success. I think the odds were always very long that Russia could achieve a war-winning or an effect that would drive Kyiv to the negotiating table in 2024. And I think this opens up possibilities for 2025 that are much more positive from a Ukrainian point of view.
I wonder if I could sort of pick up on this idea of what the narrative looks like. And because it strikes me as somewhat of a double-edged sword in the sense that things were going reasonably well for Ukraine, the administration and European allies were sort of happy to take a backseat to the events, especially when the bill was being held up in Congress and Ukrainians were, you know, not making any gains, and to the contrary, the Russians were taking over small villages and towns. I think it sort of created a sense of urgency, if not panic, in some European capitals, hence the Czech munitions initiative, hence the Baltics stepping up in a major way diplomatically and through assistance. And I think one of the biggest dangers of what I consider, you know, a great success, and I was relieved as anybody to hear the news this weekend, is that the administration and perhaps some European allies will say, okay, we're helping to stabilize the lines, and that's where, you know, our job ends. And I think if this were sort of a precursor to a return to business as usual in the way the administration has been sort of helping Ukraine, I don't think it would be great news. I mean, you know, like, it's better than the sort of counterfactual in which we are not helping at all. But I would very much like this to be a sort of moment in which we sort of come to the brink and we stepped away from the brink and we are going to just be far more serious about helping the Ukrainians. So I wrote something to this effect for America's favorite mid-market newspaper earlier this week, the New York Post. You can include the link in the show notes. Biden now has the money, and there is quite a bit of discretion that he has in how he uses the drawdown authority and how he contracts sort of new equipment to be made and delivered to the Ukrainians. And I just wish that this be done with Ukrainian victory in mind. And also, like, so I just saw the news that he has just signed the bill. I mean, I wish he made a speech at that occasion in which he articulated why this matters, what exactly he is going to do, and how it leads to Ukraine's victory on the battlefield. Because I don't think there is in a country like America a substitute for presidential leadership on these matters, and we've really had very little of it.
Real quickly, I will agree 200% with that. But I also hope that, I mean, one of the people will be watching to see whether it is a return to a series of baby steps or half measures. That was the critique long before we reached the impasse in Congress. So logic would dictate that Biden should exploit this opportunity in a way that would advance his candidacy, as well as providing the international leadership that's been rather tepid up until this point.
Yeah, I wonder in that context, and I guess from both of you on the U.S. side, I have a couple of questions, and then on the Eastern European side, as a matter of fact, too, to what extent we have hopes that this will force the administration and Biden himself in any change of strategy. I think it was Dalibor who said earlier, back to regular business. I feel like reading the bill, it provides for a nudge towards it, but there's ways to get around it. And I wonder, to what extent do you perceive, both of you, that there is hope for the administration to change the line from the regular and to actually own Ukrainian victory? Because we haven't seen the administration talking about Ukrainian victory, and they're nearing the end, and it doesn't seem like Biden wants to put this forth as a part of the campaign, as a part of an achievement. So I'm a bit worried about that. But then the second part, I guess, is two questions: the U.S. side, the Republican side, and then in Eastern Europe, the big speculation theme about how this came about. And the first question is, what role did Trump play? How unhappy or happy was he with these decisions, given that we've had quite a few visits to Florida over the last few days, including last week, including Mike Johnson, and statements coming out of that from Mike Johnson as well as from Trump. And then the Eastern European and last element here on the Republican side, we still have, I mean, Mike Johnson, to his credit, maybe he thinks about coming on the podcast, to his credit, might have worked really hard on this to gain sufficient numbers to get this through. It looked like that over the last few weeks, but we still have 112 MAGAs opposing it. So what does that mean for the argument on the Republican side for Ukraine? And how does that impact the administration? Because they have to factor that into. And then the last question here is, to what extent did Poland, and I guess Lithuania too, play a role? There's been quite a bit of speculation on social media, and not only that, the visit of the Polish president, particularly to Trump in Florida, talking about Ukraine in a very, I'm guessing, Polish pragmatic way. If we don't help them now, it's going to be more expensive for us, and we don't want to do that. But also talking about nukes and how Poland is ready for that, and Trump going out and saying, I will support Poland all the way. I've always had the impression that at the beginning of the war, it's been Ukraine first and foremost, but also countries in the region that have been going to Washington to lobby the administration to change its position from no javelins or just a few javelins to something more significant. So I wonder how both of you evaluate whether the Eastern Europeans had, Central Eastern Europeans had, a role to play in changing the mind of including Donald Trump.
So I'll let Giselle respond, but first I want to offer a factual correction. So President Duda visited Trump not in Mar-a-Lago, but in New York City between the sittings of the court as jury was being selected.
I think the world is a better place when Donald Trump is nodding off in a courtroom. That we can take away for sure. In the House, a majority of Republicans voted against Ukraine aid. But this issue is one of the few things where normie Republicans are willing to stand up against Trump, to put country above party and personal interest. That is not nothing. That is not insignificant. You know, 70%+ of the Congress voted in favor of aiding Ukraine, and that number basically reflects the split in American public opinion. The question is, will this sort of be one of the things that marginalizes MAGA and convinces people that it is, in fact, first of all, Trumpian cult of personality, but one that, again, puts Trump's interests and partisan interests above the national interest, which is a big problem for Republicans, not just for Trump as a presidential candidate, but down the ballot. There's still, in conservative America, a really strong dislike for Vladimir Putin that is almost baked into the equation. So I would say if Mike Johnson can do this, then others can do this as well.
So Giselle, you used the phrase standing up against Trump on this issue, and I certainly don't want to get into the business of, you know, making excuses or rationalizations for Trump. So I don't want to go down that route. However, I will say that, I mean, in this particular case, it was not so much an instance of standing up against Trump as it was a case, and Trump was sort of convinced by perhaps Speaker Johnson or other actors to just stay out of it completely. But it was a case of sort of standing up against that kind of MAGA movement, which Trump created, you could say, but that I think has taken on a life of its own, and in the sort of revolutionary logic of, like, you know, eating its own children, I think it, like, risks Trump's electoral victory, right? Like, if Republicans had another motion of no confidence in the Speaker and ended up with a Democratic Speaker potentially, or you know, something along those lines, and, like, the next 3 months were spent talking about, like, who the next speaker is going to be, as opposed to any semblance of legislative work. I mean, that would reflect very poorly on Republicans. I don't think it would help Trump. It's just, like, something had been sort of set in motion with, you know, Trump's major contribution that now is sort of beyond any individual's control, it seems. And I think, yeah, I think the way you deal with it is that you try to sort of cauterize it and just isolate it, as you put it. And I do wonder myself whether Republicans might be nearing that moment that, like, people have to say that this is a dead end, right? Like, they're like Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world, have no interest in governing or moving the needle on anything. And, you know, I wonder if we could ever have this conversation with somebody from Heritage or people who are sort of preparing for the next Trump term. So like, okay, like, if you do have major victories, if you control the White White House and the legislature? Like, what are you going to do? What's your sort of agenda domestically, internationally, that's not just culture war posturing? How are you going to, like, build sort of political coalitions to get any of it done?
I mean, question for the heritage people that I can't possibly answer. One thing that I don't think got enough attention, this was kind of a smackdown of Marjorie Taylor Greene to a certain degree. You know, again, trying to channel the Trump vibe a little bit. I think he may have seen her getting too big for her britches, saw her extreme ranting on this as a threat to his own control over his own campaign, and if nothing else, just sort of, you know, drawing the media's attention away from me, Donald Trump, in a way that, again, caused Trump to turn the volume down on his Ukraine objections, give a big pat on the back to the speaker, you know, saying he's doing a good job, so on and so forth, and just kind of moderating or modulating his level of outrage in a way that, again, I think does underscore division within the Republican ranks is deeper than we might have imagined.
I would hope that there is a lesson for people who decided to go full Putin in this past couple of months. Everybody from Senator Johnson, Ron Johnson, through J.D. Vance's of the world, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, that this is actually not a very popular position with the American people, and that I have no illusions about these people's backbones or anything like that, but like, if politically dangerous to take the sort of full Putin position, then fewer people will do so, and I think that will make for a much healthier conversation on Ukraine and any other number of subjects.
That is the soft bigotry of low expectations on display, but I quite agree.
So I guess under the rubric of what's next and the big question of was this the last supplemental aid package for Ukraine, either way, because if Biden stays, he had so much trouble getting it through. I don't see how he can do that next year, given that I'm guessing he will not change strategy radically and overperform after underperforming. Or if Trump comes, he wasn't too keen on it. It wasn't like he changed position and went out and said, oh my God, I love Ukraine now and we need to defeat Russia. And so under this rubric, the big question is, and I'm looking at Dalibor here, can we find money for Ukraine without the supplemental? And is there something to the fourth bill that creates this, from what I'm understanding, legal, unprecedented move to seize frozen assets? It's created a lot of discussion, including with the head of the European Bank going out just a few hours before the vote to warn the United States not to do it. I'm guessing the only price, and Dalibor, correct me if I'm wrong, the only risk here that we're talking about is that the mafia and the oligarchs of the world will be more reticent to put money into the Western system. But, you know, the alternative is the Chinese yuan or the Russian ruble. So I don't see why we should be worrying that much about it, even if we are completely void of ethics on both sides of the Atlantic. But then when I talked about this with Dalibor, he told me, now, it's only the first move. So Dalibor, would you explain whether there's hope for Ukraine to get money from Russia, directly or indirectly, to be able to continue the war?
Sure. So my understanding, first of all, is that this is about Russian sovereign assets, right? Not about assets of Russian oligarchs. So Russian oligarchs, for good or ill, I think have reasons to be fairly confident in the strength of private property protections by Western legal systems. And I think, yeah, it's a tricky subject. Like, you know, I would like to sort of seize this stuff as much as anybody, like the sort of yachts and real estate and assets that all these monsters have stolen and placed in Western financial capitals. But I mean, we do live in a system of laws, and many of these people are citizens of Western countries and have recourse to the same due process as everybody else. So I don't think there is a sort of feasible path towards really sort of getting a lot of money from the hands of Russian oligarchs and kleptocrats and getting it to Ukraine. Where there is a possible, both politically and legally feasible, way forward is by going after Russian sovereign assets. So this bill does that. It does that for assets that are based in the United States, which is a relatively modest amount, right? I don't think we'll be sort of seizing consular buildings and embassy buildings and those kinds of things. We'll if there is going to be anything seized, it's going to be the reserves of the Russian Central Bank, which are invested in the United States. I'm told that's less than $10 billion, might be closer to six. I mean, the big prize are the assets of the Russian Central Bank that are in Europe, especially in an organization called Euroclear, which is sort of like a clearing organization based in Belgium that hosts close to 190, maybe $200 billion worth of Russian Central Bank reserves. And on that front, you know, it could be done, but it would require, I think, much sort of bolder moves on the part of the Europeans. So there is this law in the US. I think it's a helpful precedent, but the debate in Europe has been taking place at a much more modest level, where people are talking about taxing windfall profits from the sort of return that this money makes, which is a few billion a year, and giving that money to the Ukrainians. Now, that might very well happen. Obviously, it will be challenged in courts by Russia and so on and so forth. If Europeans wanted to go further, I think they could. I mean, you could very easily just create the legal basis for this. Like, I'm not an international lawyer, but sort of countries that would sort of participate in this, if I have to include Belgium, obviously, could say, look, Russia is waging a proxy war against us in Ukraine, and is sort of inflicting all this devastation, and 6.5 million refugees came from Ukraine as a result of this to European countries. Therefore, we are, you know, seizing this money. End of story. And they could sort of sign treaty or come up with some sort of ad hoc sort of legal instrument to make it happen. It wouldn't be lawless. It's just we are not quite in a state of war, but, you know, very close to it. And I think that could justify, you know, just doing things that would not be done normally, and doing so without rattling investors and eroding confidence in stability of Western legal systems. That said, I just don't see it happening quite yet. And so if that's not feasible, I think in something even like relatively more modest could be helpful, namely if we could get at least like G7 leaders or some sort of common EU, UK, US statement out that would say, look, these sovereign assets, which have already been frozen and that Russians don't directly control, we could say, look, we are not unfreezing this stuff until we are confident that Russia has A, lost the war, will contribute towards Ukraine's reconstruction, and will never ever try this again. So it would be just a political statement, but it would sort of make it clear that Russian Central Bank is not getting this money back until we have a favorable outcome to this war that Russia has unleashed on the Ukrainians, and until we have a green light from the Ukrainians that, yes, Russia is contributing towards Ukraine's reconstruction going forward.
Can I ask two follow-up questions? You said that you don't think that the Europeans will be moving towards seizing these assets. Why do you think that is? Or I guess the other question is, what would it take creatively to convince the Europeans to at least inch forward on that decision? And let me just leave it at that.
I mean, this is purely speculative, of course. I think there would have to be a much stronger sense of sort of Europeans being in something sort of resembling a war with Russia for them to be able to sort of contemplate this move. The EU is, as an entity, is just like based on rules and rule following, and everything has to be, you know, super legalistic. And the idea, you know, that we sort of sometimes have to scrap rules to react to real world events is just very alien to the Brussels mindset. I think it scares the heck out of the Germans in particular. I think, like, you know, like with a different chancellor in Germany, with different political culture in Germany, maybe like you could sort of get something along these lines moving, but I don't see it in the current constellation.
Yeah, I'd just like to pile on and say that this is no way to fight a war or to finance a war, really. I mean, this is why nation states and alliances were created, to be able to raise funds for national defense and national security. And boy, it'd be lovely and in sort of poetic justice to deprive the horrible people and the horrible regime of those assets. But I would quite agree with Dalibor that it's something maybe best saved for a post-war settlement, rather than providing assets to win the war in the first place.
I mean, to me, I understand the sort of political appeal of talking about this, and obviously it has to be like, you know, like something will happen to those assets after the war, and we can then have a sort of negotiations with Russians about it. But like in the first instance, we don't necessarily as collective West have a liquidity problem, right? Like we can sort of give money to Ukrainians.
We can still borrow our way to perdition if we wish to.
Like it's not siphoning massive parts of our public budget, we can easily sort of double down on our support and there'll be no sort of economic consequences on our end. Is it just we sort of made these political choices not to really go as far as we should, which is highly unfortunate. So to me, I mean, and that actually I was going to make another point, which is this debate about loans for Ukraine as opposed to grants. And so there is something to that effect in the current legislation. But I would again like sort of caution against that kind of nickel and diming, because from, you know, our perspective, like the goal of helping Ukraine achieve victory in the war is not just for the sake of Ukraine's military victory, but it's for the sake of helping to turn Ukraine into a stable, successful country in the long term that will be stakeholder in the community of Western democracies, that will be a sort of strong pillar of the European Union and of NATO and so on and so forth. And the way to do it is not by like piling debt on debt for Ukrainian public finances. You have to sort of realize that they are fighting an actual war. I have some numbers like in front of me about their public finances. So they have annual budget of around $80 billion. Half of it goes towards fighting the war. Half of it is everything else that the government is supposed to do, from running fire stations and paying pensions and paving roads and so on and so forth. Their tax revenue covers $40 billion, yields sort of $40 billion in revenue every year. So basically like half of the budget is, you know, they either have to borrow in international markets, not very good terms. They can get our foreign aid, or they can have recourse, and they've done that, to senior rich. They can sort of print the money and buy their own public debt. And when they did it in early phases of the war, they ran into double-digit inflation. So one of the intended benefits of U.S. assistance and international assistance to Ukraine is that Ukraine has had, by and large, a sort of normally functioning private economy throughout this war, like without sort of extraordinary measures, without price controls, without nationalizations. There have been some, but by and large, banks are stable, shops have food at market prices, and just like life goes on as usual. And that's a great starting point for any post-war reconstruction. So if we sort of destroy this because we are focused on, you know, whether there are loans or grants going to Ukraine and because we don't want to spend too much, now if you are trying to do it on the cheap side, we can sort of end up with the Ukraine that will be in a far worse starting position to be a successful country after the war.
You think about Germany in the 1920s. I mean, if we impose rigorous repayment terms on a society that's just gone through a horrible, even if Ukraine is victorious in the end, it will have suffered horribly for a long time. Even introducing this loan language into the dialogue is mischievous.
And so actually, like, legislators, when they talked about this, they would be like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we know these loans are not going to be repaid. But then, like, you know, like, why do this charade, like, for the sake of appeasing Marjorie Taylor Greene? Like, it's just not dignified. Moreover, I mean, since you brought up Germany, like, most successful post-war reconstruction in history is obviously Germany after the Second World War. And one of the features of this was that much of Germany's public debt was cancelled by Allied nations in the early 50s or early 40s. Starting on a blank slate, you know, Ukraine right now has a debt to GDP ratio of around 100%, which is close to where the United States is, close to where France is. Obviously, these other countries can borrow at much better terms and don't raise as many eyebrows among investors as a country that's actually, you know, fighting a war and doesn't control 20% of its territory.
Just to add here, in defense of the bill temporarily, but attacking the Europeans, my homeland, the loans that are in this bill are forgivable. And so that's probably what's going to happen. And like Dalibor alluded to, I think it's important to know that this is to appease, it's symbolic, it's a small amount of the whole bill, and it is to appease the Marjories of this world and essentially Russian propaganda. Now, I haven't seen Russian propaganda for a good reason, strong on, oh, Ukraine is just taking our money in Europe, where we have entirely loans or almost entirely loans as opposed to grants. So shouldn't then the arguments that Dalibor has just given be particularly focused on the Europeans that are in charge of managing Ukraine support economically and financially to reconsider the policy to be able to help Ukraine in the medium and long term?
That's exactly right. So Ukraine Facility, which is the EU instrument, I might have said it on this podcast before, and I apologize in that case, it's worth 50 billion euros. Two-thirds of that are loans to Ukraine, as if Ukraine needed, you know, more public debt. It's just not a sensible way to do this.
All right. So then as we're wrapping up, the question still remains, where can we get politically the money for the next tranche of aid for Ukraine that is, I think, intended tended to just hold the lines in the absence of more political willingness from either side of the Atlantic. How do we manage to get through another $60 billion in the next year? Is that coming from Europe?
I'll let Giselle answer that question.
Giselle, you may have the last word.
Well, let's not be cheese pairing. First of all, we should, so $60 billion, if you're buying weapons, you can spend that very, very quickly. But we should, I think, see this as not the conclusion to a saga, but a new chapter in a saga, hopefully one where we will have learned from our mistakes thus far. I mean, a door has been opened for the president, and shame on him if he doesn't really walk through it as boldly as he possibly can. And it's not just about his prospects as a presidential candidate, but he has a chance to really, you know, reclaim the narrative and the actuality of American leadership, not only in Europe, but globally speaking. Like I say, he's got an opportunity, one that could redound very much to his benefit as a politician, but also to the United States' benefit as a nation and that old crazy free world kind of a thing. So the opportunity must be seized. Getting squeamish about asking for the next $60 billion or hemming and hawing and, you know, being uncertain about what the purpose and the proper end of the war should be. Let's not repeat the mistakes that we have made until this moment. He's been given a second lease on life, and he'll be raked over the Eastern Front coals if he doesn't do as we say.
So with this friendly message to the administration, I'm afraid it's time to wrap up. From me, Dalibor Rohaj.
Me, Giselle Donnelly. And
Yulia Zsozsa.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Front, a podcast dedicated to security challenges that have erupted along the line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, AEI.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do get in touch with us on Twitter using the hashtag EasternFrontPod, written as one word, and don't forget to sign up for the Eastern Front's newsletter through the link included in the show notes to receive more content from the Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Thank you, and good night.